I can hear Bill Unruh discussing collapse of the wave function, which is what he told us not to worry about. Okay, so what I'd like to do in this talk is make things a little bit more concrete. I've been very pleased to hear in the discussions at this workshop, people keep referring to the universe and gravity and the wave function of the universe as if these are big, scary things. In fact, we live in the golden age of observations of the universe. We have more clues than we've ever had, and I really want to encourage people interested in quantum foundations to think about these clues and whether quantum foundations may actually help us to describe reality and the universe. So this work is done with Stefan Chilin, who's a postdoc at Imperial College, will shortly appear in PRL, and Job Feldbrugger, who's my PhD student here at Perimeter. Here's the universe. Beautiful picture. We live in the middle of it. It's a solar system. We live in the middle of the observable universe. We certainly do. Perimeter is exactly rare. And in fact, we're creating a new center for cosmology at Perimeter called the Center for the Universe. So it's an entirely appropriate picture. As we go outwards, we see galaxies. As we go out, we look back in time. We see the early hot universe, the decoupling of the photons, the microwave background. And right back 14 billion light years away is the Big Bang singularity itself. And due to advances with gravitational waves, we are now looking forward to actually probing these very early moments using gravitational waves. So this is becoming very real. And the kind of issues which you worry about in quantum foundations are actually crucial in tackling these observations, as I will describe. The wonderful thing about the universe, it's probably the simplest thing we know. It's in many senses simpler than a molecule. The whole universe we know on large scales is described by just six numbers. Four numbers telling us the composition of the universe, the matter in the universe, radiation, baryons, dark matter, and dark energy. Of course, these are still mysterious. And only two numbers describing the geometry of the universe. One is the amplitude of the fluctuations, which came out of the Big Bang, a few parts in 100,000. And secondly, there's a slight tilt in the spectrum. These fluctuations are basically as simple as they possibly could be. They're scale invariant, they're Gaussian to approximately 1% precision, no non-Gaussianity detected at all. And the spectrum of the fluctuations grows very slightly as you go to larger scales, but it's a tiny effect. And the observational uncertainties are now way smaller than they were just a couple of decades ago.
What are the units of your densities?
Critical. So critical density is the density you infer from Einstein's equation that the Hubble constant, the Friedman equation, the Hubble constant is related through Newton's constant to the density. And so here we would have the density of radiation plus baryons plus dark matter plus dark energy. And then if space is curved, you have an extra term which describes the spatial curvature. And so what we do is we pull the 3/8 pi g onto this side and define this to be the critical density. So if these numbers add up to equal this value, then we say it's a flat. Then we can infer it's consistent with being a flat universe, that this term is zero. So if there's no spatial curvature, these numbers add up to the critical density. So it's convenient to measure all densities in terms of this number, which is the critical density. And rather remarkably, they do all add up to the critical density, and things are consistent with a flat universe, and that's saying that the contribution of the curvature is so far undetectable in the universe. There are lots of zeros. The universe is incredibly simple. There's no spatial curvature. The dark energy has a simplest possible equation of state. The pressure is minus the density because the strength tensor is proportional to the Minkowski metric, and that makes it Lorentz invariant. It's extremely simple stuff that dominates the universe. The gravitational wave amplitude compared to the scalar amplitude, which is measured in these terms, is so far undetectable, despite some claims. A little while ago, those claims went away. There seem to be no gravitational waves, as far as we can tell, coming out of the early universe. The change of the spectral index with scale is so far negligible. The non-Gaussianity is so far negligible to better than 1%. And we live in this stunningly, stunningly simple universe. It's stunningly simple, but it's also stunningly puzzling. So in these set of six numbers, there are some very strange coincidences. And these are easy to see because these different forms of energy scale differently as the universe expands. Radiation density goes as 1/4 because every photon energy decreases as the universe expands, and then the volume grows. So radiation goes down as 8^4, matter is 8^-3, dark energy does not change as the universe expands. And so in the early universe, we're dominated by radiation. At some point when the size of the universe, A, was about 1/10,000th, the current size, matter started to dominate in the form of the dark matter and baryons. And then, rather recently, the dark energy took over, and in the future will completely dominate the universe. So the coincidences are that all these things happen around the same time. I mean, within a factor of 10,000 in scale, if you include this event, things sort of happen around the same time, and there is no reason at all in what we know about fundamental physics for that to happen. So the dark energy is the most puzzling thing of all, because in the conventional classical picture of the universe, the notion would, and this is something which inflation theory does not change at all, you basically set some initial condition for the universe, and you tune various things or somehow invoke laws of physics which tune various things to be right, you let it go, and 14 billion years later, you find yourself here. Well, if this is true, the dark energy was completely negligible near the singularity. It had a density of 10^-120 and was just somehow tuned that it only became important very recently. This is extremely strange. So that's why I'm very interested in ideas of post-selection and a final boundary condition and non-locality in general, because I think probably that's the only way we're going to solve these puzzles. I should mention, of course, some people look at these puzzles and they say, oh, anthropic principle, and they invoke that as an explanation. I have nothing against the anthropic principle, but it has to be implemented in a proper way. You can't even begin to implement it without a measure, without, for that you generally need a, you know, quantum theory or some statistical theory at least. And so it's very, very poorly implemented. That's my objection to it. Again, I think, you know, the historically quantum theory was crucial to understanding a well-defined measure in statistical physics, and I expect the same will be true in cosmology. Could there be strong quantumness in the universe? My view is undoubtedly there is strong quantumness. This dark energy, we already know that in traditional ways of calculating the vacuum energy in quantum field theory, we get huge contributions from the vacuum fluctuations of the fields we know about. So this is almost certainly at least heavily influenced by quantum mechanics. And furthermore, the fluctuations in the density, as I've already mentioned, these fluctuations of a part in 100,000, they take the statistical character of a quantum mechanical free field in its vacuum. That's again a hint that on very large scales, quantum mechanics played a big role. So this is all the known laws of physics. Of course, they're combined into a path integral. This is our best representation of them. There are a few things missing from the formula, but this is an amazingly successful and complete formula, which combines all the physical laws we know. And the most recent part of it has to be explored, the Higgs boson, has again given us an amazing coincidence, which is that if you take the minimal standard model and extrapolate from LHC measurements right up to the Planck scale, two rather incredible things happen. One is that the vacuum we live in of the Higgs field with spontaneous symmetry breaking is not the lowest energy vacuum in the standard model. There's another one. And the second coincidence is that the second minimum lives at around the Planck scale. And this is entirely a prediction from particle physics, in which gravity was not even involved in any part of the calculation. So the suggestion is that somehow electroweak physics knows about the Planck scale. That's what this implies. And even more bizarrely, that the true vacuum in the standard model of particle physics is lower than the one we live in. Okay, so now this can all be altered by introducing extra fields and particles above the weak scale, but this is a pretty interesting clue from standard model physics.
You didn't have any integration measure in that formula.
What's that?
Integration measure in the previous formula is
messy. I just didn't have space. It's almost unique. Okay, there's some issues about it, but it's to the extent of with the standard model fields, it's unique. So the final path integral. Let's think a little bit more about this. This is totally fundamental to how we formulate the laws of known laws of physics. When we start to do quantum gravity, it is the most natural formulation, incorporating all the right symmetries and the things Bill talked about. So let me just make a very elementary point about it. First of all, it absolutely naturally incorporates pre- and post-selection. So when you talk about Feynman path integrals, you can't really avoid talking about pre-selection of the initial state, post-selection of the final state. This integral tells you the overlap between those two states. Secondly, in the semi-classical approximation, in which I send h-bar to zero, and it makes perfect sense that when we're describing big things like the world, the cosmos, we should only expect something close to a classical description in that limit. In the semi-classical approximation, classical saddle point trajectories, in other words, saddle points of this infinite dimensional integral, are generically complex. They're not real at all. Okay, they're generically complex. And I'm going to come back to this in the way in which I handle quantum gravity. I'm going to allow myself to use the complex plane. It's a very natural thing to do with any sort of contour integral. The action, of course, is a contour integral. The path integral is also a contour integral, infinite dimensional one. And I'm going to allow myself to deform contours into the complex plane. This is done in any case in conventional quantum field theory in various respects with the I epsilon prescription and so on, and I'm going to do that as well. Now, just as a particular example, which I found very instructive, when we study quantum mechanical tunneling of an ordinary particle, and you specify an initial state for the particle, for example, a Gaussian wave packet, localized around the false vacuum, and you specify the final state, saying that the particle was observed at a particular x final at some particular time, you can ask which trajectory dominated the path integral, which classical trajectory dominated. And this is the answer. The particle jiggles around in the complex x plane. It goes round and round in a positive frequency mode. And the nonlinear secular nonlinear terms in the potential create secular growth in the trajectory, causing it to run out in the complex plane, and then it comes back, bounces off the outside of the potential, and rolls off to infinity. So
this is the value of the exponential of the action?
No, this is x of t. This is the classical solution, which is the saddle point to the path integral. Okay, so it's a unambiguous thing. And so weak measurements would actually detect this complex classical trajectory. Quantum gravity. So quantum gravity, you're interested in studying amplitudes taking from one state of the universe, meaning its three-dimensional geometry and distribution of matter fields, to another state of the universe via some putative four-dimensional geometry, which interpolates between these two three-dimensional geometries. So this is the object you'd like to study in quantum gravity. There are some beautiful papers on this written by Bryce DeWitt in particular, and Bill already referred to this, that the Hamiltonian in canonical general relativity looks like this, roughly speaking. Second derivative with respect to the spatial metric, this gamma ij is the spatial metric. Second derivative with respect to that, an additional potential term, and then we should actually also add terms involving the matter. They also come into the Hamiltonian. But this annihilates the state. There is no preferred time in quantum gravity, and that forces the Hamiltonian to vanish on all physical states. It's a Klein-Gordon-like equation, not a Schrodinger-like equation. And so psi squared, modulus psi squared integrated over its arguments is not conserved. So that's not a sensible candidate for the probability in quantum mechanics, in quantum gravity. DeWitt proposed a conserved inner product, which roughly speaking is just the Klein-Gordon norm, psi star I d naught both ways psi, integrated over the spatial coordinates on the space of fields. But the problem with this is it's not positive. So you have a notion of a conserved quantity, but it's not positive. So what I'm going to do later in the talk is actually give a proposal for a sensible quantity, which is both positive and conserved, and I believe to be new in the quantum gravity. I want to quote a particular paragraph from DeWitt's paper, which I think emphasizes what Bill was saying about the very deep puzzles in quantum gravity, but from a much more optimistic, I think, point of view. The most impressive fact which emerges is that it's extraordinarily economical. It gives us what is needed to analyze the situation, not a bit more. It will say nothing about time, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says, when quantum theory and gravity are united, the result is an operational theory par excellence. Okay? So it's an extremely minimalistic theory. And I think that's wonderful. It's just up to us to figure out what the hell it means. Okay? So our starting point was to say, can we construct some plausible, simple model of cosmology? I emphasize the simple, which we can actually calculate things in and learn what this funny theory actually means. Now, this is a big subject, quantum cosmology, but usually the first step in quantum cosmology is to introduce some arbitrary scalar field, an arbitrary potential, because you're hoping to get inflation out of it, and then you can't solve anything, and then you end up even more confused than when you began. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to take the simplest type of matter, namely, we're going to take conformally invariant matter. This is extremely well motivated. The only quantum field theories which are believed to be complete in the ultraviolet are conformally invariant in the ultraviolet. The beta function vanishes in the UV, like QCD, and these can be defined independently of any UV cutoff. They have a very special quantum cosmology related to their viol invariance. They don't have a scale, and literally the matter does not see the expansion of the universe. If you have light, light doesn't really detect the expansion of the universe. It's only when you have a massive particle measuring the light, the massive particle could tell that there's a frequency shift, but the light itself doesn't see the expansion. So let's take this type of matter. We'll start by truncating cosmology to the most symmetrical situation, which is actually a really good approximation to our universe, valid to one part in 100,000, that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, and it's going to have conformal matter, which we will take to be a pure radiation fluid, so a fluid with a stress tensor whose trace vanishes, and M-free conformally coupled scalar fields. And this is really just a proxy for the Higgs field or whatever, but it's the minimal thing we can do, which allows us to compute everything exactly. We want to study the behavior of the quantum, the background, Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe in this model, and it turns out this can be solved exactly. And it's kind of strange, this was not noticed before, but actually the simplest cosmology can be solved exactly. Furthermore, it describes a perfect cosmological bounce. So let's begin by looking at this. Friedman-Robertson-Walker means homogeneity and isotropy of space. So the spatial metric is basically H3, E3, or S3. For this hyperbolic space has negative curvature, E3 is zero curvature, S3 is positive curvature. And then we simply have a scale factor of the universe telling us how big that space is. So that's the most general Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. It just has a single dynamical degree of freedom, the size of the universe. Now, when we look at the trace of the Einstein equations, that directly relates the Ricci scalar to T lambda lambda, the trace of the stress tensor, and for radiation, that's zero. And basically, the Ricci scalar for FRW will go like A double dot over A cubed plus kappa over A squared. And you can easily see that as A goes to zero, this implies that this scale factor goes like eta, the conformal time. So for very general reasons, this scale factor vanishes like eta at small times. Why is that nice? Because this is a bounce, okay? Take A squared, it's eta squared. Think about the size of the universe. You know, the only thing entering in the metric is eta squared. This describes a metric which shrinks to zero like eta squared and reappears again. Smoothly, it's completely smooth. There's a unique analytic extension from negative to positive scale factor. So that's what we call a perfect bounce. It's a bounce controlled by a perfect fluid of the simplest type and well worth exploring. Now, the second thing, if you start studying perturbations around this universe, gravitational waves, density perturbations, you discover they also have beautiful analytic properties, no branch cuts at eta equals zero, and a unique extension from positive to negative eta. So these are all sort of classical hints that there's something special about this situation. So let's now add a bunch of conformally coupled scalars. These are scalar fields called chi. We choose them to have a particular coupling to the Ricci scalar to maintain this invariance under conformal transformations. By the way, conformal or viol transformations look like this. So G mu nu goes like this, where this is of any function of x, and a scalar field will, in four dimensions, will scale like this. So there's a local gauge symmetry of this action. I've introduced M of these chi fields and also another spurious field, phi, which is introduced to make the gravitational action conform viol invariant. Okay? So this combined action, including the Einstein-Hilbert term, is now classically viol invariant. And why do I do that? Well, it allows us to separate out the degree of freedom, which is the size of the universe, in a particularly clean way. Okay, so it's just a completely mathematical reason. I could always pick a vial gauge in which this coefficient was 1, but it's actually easier to work in this lifted picture and pick a vial gauge in which the 3 metric of space is static. So I can pick a gauge in which the universe isn't expanding, okay? And that's very convenient. So basically, I've just pushed the expansion into this other degree of freedom, and then it's simply convenient for the maths to do that. So here's my metric. This gamma ij is a static metric. The density of radiation in this gauge is classically a constant, and quantum mechanically you find it's a conserved number, and again, it also turns out to be constant. So we're sitting there in the static universe, but we have the spurious field around, which is actually encoding the expansion of the universe, describing all of the correct dynamics. So now I take this picture, and I notice that this scale factor field, if you like, this phi field, has a time-like direction in its kinetic term. The kinetic term defines the metric on field space. And so if I combine phi with chi into some m plus 1 vector in a space which has a Minkowski metric, then this is the action. So it's a very beautiful action. It has time. It has this n function or lapse function, which builds in time reparameterization invariance. The density of the radiation, density of it was parameterized by this number r. The volume of the universe is V naught. These combine into the mass m. So the universe has a mass, but basically the action for the universe is the same as that for a relativistic particle with the addition of this x squared term. Here's the Hamiltonian. We can make a gauge choice that this lapse function is the proper time. So the way we describe our transition amplitude is by using a parameter time, which just goes from, say, minus 1 to 1 on the two geometries, and then a proper time, which is the proper time as measured by the metric for how long it took to go from one geometry to the other. The Feynman propagator is given by this. And now, in this model, the path integrals are all Gaussian, so they can be done exactly, leaving one with a single ordinary integral, this tau integral, and that, too, can be done exactly. So this mass, m, which appears in the Hamiltonian as a mass, is literally the mass of the universe. It's a conserved number. If you work it out in Einstein frame, so if I go disentangle all this conformal stuff and go back to Einstein frame, this mass is what matters is actually a dimensionless number, which is the value of the action telling you how classical you are. And this number turns out to be the Hubble constant in Einstein frame times the volume of the universe in Einstein frame. So I'm imagining a torus or a sphere or some compact hyperbolic universe with some volume. And you can see that this quantity goes to 0 at early times. And so the universe, the quantum fluctuations in the size of the universe become large as t goes to 0. But at late times, providing this number is large, the background is heavy, it doesn't spread much, and back reaction from the fluctuations is small. So we're left with this path integral. And I wanted to make a point that the path integral actually, in a sense, defines its own boundary conditions. You can use the integral itself to define its boundary conditions with very modest number of inputs. OK, so we're supposed to integrate over tau. This proper time. And it's plausible you should only integrate from 0, because after all, the time you take from one slice to the next should presumably start from zero. And then we will allow this integral to find its own infinity. You want to integrate over all values of tau, but not necessarily constrain it to the real line, just allow this integral to go where it will. The action looks like this. It has, so you can do the Gaussian, Gaussian integral. This is, sorry, I didn't say this. This is the flat case. Kappa equals zero is particularly easy. This is the usual relativistic particle propagator. The Gaussian integral can be done exactly. It has a unique, every Gaussian integral has a unique saddle point that defines the steepest descent contour that defines the integral. But you're left with this tau integral. The tau integral has a couple of saddle points. I've only shown one. This is the one which gives the right behavior at large spatial separations, causing the correlator to die as with large spatial separation. And the saddle point, if you're at time-like separations, is on the real axis. Space-like separations is on the imaginary axis. What you do is take that saddle point, construct the steepest descent contour from it to the point zero and to the point to infinity in the complex tau plane, and that totally defines the propagator. There's no need for an I epsilon if you take this point of view. So this is the kind of calculation we get in the cosmological case. We need to interpret these variables in terms of the cosmology. This time-like variable, the x0, remember it was the phi field, and the x spatial variables were the chi fields, so we're now living in field space. Quantity A is actually the scale factor of the universe is given by the length of this vector. So what I do is, you see, this if I have a space-time like a Minkowski space, and I want to construct a Lorentz invariant time-like coordinate, this is how I do it. I consider hyperboloids here, n squared equals minus 1. I consider the a vector ending on that hyperboloid. It has a scale in it, and this is so-called Milne time, but it's a Lorentz invariant time. So this is a very natural time variable in the problem. It can be either positive, as it is in this region, negative in this region, or it can even be imaginary, because where x squared is positive, so in space-like regions, and it's zero on these light cones. So we're going to describe everything in terms of this Lorentz invariant time, which will take both negative values, positive values, and even imaginary values. The propagator you calculate decays exponentially in the space-like regions. In fact, if you think about this, you realize that in relativistic, in field theory, that decay is coming from a saddle point, i.e. a classical solution, which has an imaginary lapse function. In other words, it is a complex classical solution, and that saddle point is the one that gives you the correct. So in a sense, when a particle, when a field, quantum field, decays outside its light cone, what it is doing is quantum tunneling, using an imaginary, using a complex solution to reach into those regions. In the time-like regions, the propagator oscillates. Here's an example, the open universe, kappa equals minus 1, propagator. I've just considered the propagation from some negative a, if a naught is some number, from some negative a to some positive a, and here's the function. It's a complex complex function. It describes an open universe which contracts to zero and re-expands again. Yes?
Is there an outline of the prime propagator that would only propagate to the future?
This is it.
This without an I epsilon system.
Yes.
You don't need the I epsilon prescription if you take this complex contour point of view. It all takes care of itself. The Feynman-ness comes in here when you say it goes from zero. That's it. If you put this as going from minus infinity to plus, then you'd get the Whiteman. But the Feynman one just is the one starting at zero. Okay, so all very well. We can do Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology. And now the first thing everyone says is put in some junk. Okay, what does the junk do at the singularity? So actually, the junk is rather, the simplest junk you can introduce is anisotropy. You can say, let's imagine that the three directions of space had independent scale factors. And so as I go towards the singularity, some of them could contract faster than others. In fact, generically, some contract while others expand, and the thing goes fairly wild. So this is how you describe the anisotropies. You introduce additional fields, which look like these chi scalar fields. They are scalar fields, and they parameterize the size of these three different directions. And then by definition, the sum of them is zero. So there are two extra fields. These anisotropy moduli, their metric on the space of those fields is Euclidean metric. And then, of course, we have our scalars living on this HM. And now you study this Wheeler-DeWitt operator and the Green's function and so on and so forth. I think in view of time, I'm going to skip through this unless there's any questions, just to tell you that this anisotropy can be dealt with rather beautifully, and you can fully determine the Green's function. The key trick that is used here, as I said, is to be allow oneself to define these quantities by trajectories through the complex plane, and in particular, the complex time plane, this complex A plane, because A, the size of the universe, is really the time-like coordinate on the space of fields in general relativity. So if I take the Feynman Green's function, it turns out it splits into a sum of positive frequency modes times negative frequency modes, okay? And that's just a consequence of the structure of this path integral. It splits into this product, and the positive frequency modes, by definition, are analytic in the lower half plane, so they are evolved uniquely around the singularity by going below it, and the negative frequency modes are just the complex conjugate. We've studied the inhomogeneities. There are some details in our paper. I won't go through this in detail. Our main finding is that positive frequency modes in equal positive frequency modes out. In other words, no particle production. In the limit that the matter is conformal, strictly conformal, T lambda lambda is zero, there is zero particle production as you go around this singularity and come out the other side. And the reason for this is extremely simple. There exists a Euclidean mode function that I can take this A variable up down the negative imaginary axis, and along that axis there is a mode for every value of the momentum. There's a mode which goes to zero, which is real, and goes to zero as A goes to infinity. And then the positive frequency mode is simply the analytic continuation this way and or this way. And this is enough, since you have something called Schwartz reflection. The Schwartz reflection actually guarantees that incoming positive frequency matches to outgoing positive frequency. So these are our findings for general perturbations around this solution, is that there is an annulus in the complex plane within which perturbation theory is valid. The perturbations remain small. They would blow up if I insisted on taking them all the way to A equals zero, but that's an artifact of perturbation theory. Perturbation theory fails when these amplitudes become large. In fact, they're extremely well behaved in the complex A plane, and you can show that there's an annulus within which you can just avoid the singularity and come out the other side. And so this calculation actually determines all the in-out matrix elements at the semi-classical tree level, because you can do those using complex classical solutions. Now, I want to end by coming back to this question of the probability. I mean, so you can do all these calculations, so what? Well, you have no idea what they mean, okay, until you know how to get the probability of anything in quantum gravity. And as I already told you, the two existing proposals in the literature are manifestly useless. One is psi squared, and the other one is the DeWitt norm. One is positive, the other is conserved, and neither of them can be the answer.
You mean one is negative, the other is not conserved?
One is not positive, and the other is not conserved, exactly. Okay, so here is a proposal. The proposal for the probability of a wave function psi. And it exploits this propagator. I mean, no doubt a propagator is a very fundamental property of the theory. And my idea is, let's use the propagator to construct the norm. Okay, so the dynamics of the theory will itself be used in constructing the probability measure out of a state. So I take some state, psi, and I would choose this state to represent as closely as possible the universe whose probability I want to calculate. So it will be a state which is a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and represents an expanding universe. It might have some fluctuations and so on and so forth. So that's simply the state whose probability you want to calculate is encoded in this wave function. So I take this wave function, and then I consider the Feynman propagator. I take the inner product of this wave function with the Feynman propagator on the initial surface and at some initial time. And then I take the same state, complex conjugate, and I take its inner product, but now, crucially, represented with a negative instead of positive. You see the theory has a symmetry under a goes to minus a. So I have this possibility of representing exactly the same three geometry using a negative a. So I'm going to use both of them and take the inner product of the same wave function complex conjugated with this GF. You can show this is positive. Okay, it follows from the fact that this G splits into positive and negative frequency, a sum of terms, positive time negative frequency, and basically there's a sum of terms which are complex conjugates of each other, and this is conserved and positive. What I really like about this norm is it incorporates the Big Bang. Okay, so the mere construction of a sensible probability in quantum gravity seems to incorporate the Big Bang. The positive frequency condition is global and strongly constrains the outgoing state. Nevertheless, they're very interesting opportunities for post-selection, and I noticed there's even a talk about that at this workshop. I think this is really important in the light of what I said earlier about all these coincidences. It suggests a new proposal for the quantum state of the universe, i.e. for understanding how the laws of physics might determine their own initial conditions without anything else being prescribed. So this is really only a possibility in quantum physics, and personally I find it very exciting. I was going to say something about the no-boundary proposal. Let me just say it doesn't make any sense, and I'm happy to describe why. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions, everybody? Yes, please.
So, a lot of the things that you managed to define depend quite crucially, I feel, on the singularity structure that you impose on the propagator. But This is in.
I didn't impose anything.
Okay,
anyway.
Sure. Well, you chose the seventh one, though. You called
no, I only had two choices, actually. And
right.
One of them gave exponentially growing correlate Green's function at large spatial separation.
Right.
So I made that choice. That's
right.
It. That was it.
This
that
is
really
in
was
field
it.
Space,
what?
This is in field space, though.
Yes.
So. Why should we, I mean, it's nice, but why should we expect that our notions of locality, which usually, or microcausality, that usually tell us what we should do with the singularity spectrum of the propagator, should apply in field space? I mean,
wow, the norms, the DeWitt norm, and all the structures you use involve integrating over field space, so it's really not that different. If you think things ought to converge at large separations in space, then field space is really pretty similar. It's a striking fact that in GR, the space of fields has the same signature, you know, minus plus 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 plus, as this metric on space-time.
Yes. One thing that, on my side, seems a little bit confusing about all this, you seem to eliminate so much degrees of freedoms all in one go.
Yes.
And for example, the detection force is definitely involved something else in the universe,
right.
Not just these few coordinates. And there are decoherence problems, there are problems of reduction of symmetry by the observation.
Sure.
Don't you think that this might actually be rather important for the details?
Yeah, so I'm cheating. I'm looking at the universe, we see. It's extremely symmetrical.
Yeah, but
to one part in 100,000.
Yes, but
okay. So, first approximation should be to describe that symmetrical mode. I mean, that's pretty reasonable, pretty good.
Approximation, but if you look at the quantum mechanics, you normally cannot ignore these details.
It's not a detail. I am worried about it, but
mm-hmm.
If I need to make an approximation, to I'm setting up an approximation scheme, okay? I'm not throwing away modes. I'm simply trying to describe all modes as perturbations around this homogeneous isotropic universe, which is extremely well motivated from observations. Okay, of course, later on, if one is more ambitious, we need to understand where did that homogeneity and isotropy come from? And of course, inflation was designed to explain that. And you know, one can debate whether it succeeded or not. I think it's equally possible that something like post-selection might explain that. Okay, I'm not claiming we can, but we can hope to gain some insight into that. Yeah.
I wonder if you can use the method that you introduced, probably look at the signal problem that Dan Golden creates.
Yes.
I think there is a kind of trying to discuss something that is from cells.
Yes.
If it's not from the battery.
Yes.
Or something called the battery not from cells.
Yes.
Suppose I would try to think that the Dan Golden is
yes. Yes.
When they are cooling by
yes. I've done that. Yes, it works.
It works.
The thing it will not work if I introduce nonlinear terms in the Klein Gordon, like phi cubed or phi squared, then it will not work. But I should have emphasized this. The beautiful thing about Wheeler-DeWitt, it's a linear equation. I mean, it's describing everything in the universe, all the nonlinear dynamics, and it is a linear equation. All I used here was linearity. Typically, when people study Klein-Gordon field theory, they wanted to introduce interactions, and then none of this works.
Now, I suppose
linear.
We have three Klein-Gordon,
right.
Linear bound,
right.
And assume that we had some macroscopic bound. So you can update,
right.
You would get macroscopic solutions to define the metric.
Right.
I've
gone some way, and I believe it works. Yes, I agree. I'm not sure what it means. I agree.
This is a
agree.
When it says what you are doing,
I agree.
And what you actually think about it.
Okay.
You.
Yeah, very good. Exactly.
Very high state.
Exactly.
It tries to define the unusual left state to define the method.
Absolutely.
So
the unusual thing I'm doing is using the propagator to define the inner product.
Okay. Let us thank our speaker again.